It's time for a solid hour of Tea Party Power. And now, here's Janine Garofalo's favorite tea-bagging redneck, Mark Gillar.
Good morning and welcome to the Tea Party Power Hour. I am your host, Mark Gillar. Our special guest today is Eric Stockelbeck. He is an investigative reporter on terrorism and national security and the host of Stockelbeck on Terror, a program that is on the Christian Broadcasting Network. He also is a frequent guest on places like Fox and CNN and MSNBC and the BBC. He is here today to talk to us about his new book, The Terrorist Next Door, How the Government is Deceiving You About the Islamist Threat. Eric, welcome to the show.
Hey, Mark, great to be here. Thanks for having me.
When you look at what's going on in America right now, the economy is in the tank. Everybody seems to be focused on that. Plus, Barack Obama almost single-handedly took out Osama bin Laden. So a lot of people are sort of perhaps, well, they've been lulled into a false sense of security, a bit of complacency on this issue. Am I reading it right?
You are, unfortunately, Mark. There is a sense of complacency on this issue. Look, it was a great day for America that Osama bin Laden was killed. Good riddance. And it hurt al-Qaeda. But this global radical Islamic movement is much broader than just one man. In the book, Mark, I point out what al-Qaeda's new strategy is, the new blueprint for terrorism for America. I call it the chip away strategy. Think of Fort Hood. Think of the Christmas Day underwear bomber. Think of the attempted Times Square bomber last year. Small scale, self-starters. Low-tech, inexpensive. These were cheap, these attacks. This is the new face. Al-Qaeda's hierarchy has explicitly endorsed this shift to smaller-scale attacks. Look, they want to top 9/11. We know that. They changed the course of history on that day. But in the meantime, as they're plotting the big one, and they're plotting it every day, as they're plotting that, a shift to these smaller-scale attacks. Imagine a Fort Hood every week. I call it the chip-away strategy, Mark, because if you had a bunch of these attacks carried out with frequency, shopping malls, buses, doesn't take a genius to walk into a shopping mall, yell Allahu Akbar, and start firing. It would chip away at our economy, chip away at our psyche, and think about the threat level Israel faces every day. Are we ready for that in America? I don't think so, but that's where it's heading.
I don't know how the people of Israel are as resilient as they are. It is amazing to me that anyone could live day to day with that type of threat. You mentioned the Fort Hood shooter, and that's kind of personal with me. I didn't tell you where we're located geographically, but I'm talking to you from College Station, Texas, the home of Texas A&M. And I actually knew physician assistant Mike Cahill, the only civilian killed in the Fort Hood shooting. Can't say that we were close friends, but we certainly knew each other well. We were on a first-name basis. We interacted professionally for a couple of years. And one of the things that really bothers me about this, Eric, is that there were so many warning signs that this guy was going to cause a problem. But in the name of political correctness, in the name of not wanting to offend anybody, he was allowed to continue on without being called out on it. And thanks to that, someone I know is dead. Why is it that as a society we have gotten so politically correct? I mean, we all remember Joy Behar and Whoopi Goldberg walking off The View. Right. But the bottom line is, as a society, we are so worried about hurting someone's feelings that even in the case of Major Hassan, who gave off numerous red flags, we will not do anything about that. How have we gotten to this point?
Well, Mark, first of all, God bless your friend who lost his life at Fort Hood. I think of the victims' families, the victims of Fort Hood. This could have been avoided. This should not have happened. Nidal Hassan did everything but walk around base wearing a T-shirt reading, "I am an Islamic terrorist." He was in touch with an al-Qaeda terrorist in Yemen, exchanging emails. And our government, Mark, knew about this. They knew that he was in contact with Anwar al-Awlaki, the al-Qaeda cleric. Yet, not only did they not kick him out of the military and throw him in jail where he belonged, they promoted him to major. These are the fruits, the bitter fruits of political correctness, which you're talking about, Mark. Even our military is infected with it. They still have not acknowledged. The Pentagon has done various reports since Fort Hood, taking a look at that Islamic terrorist attack, because that's what it was. the deadliest Islamic terror attack since 9/11, our Pentagon even, still has not acknowledged, has not even mentioned the word Islam in their reports on Fort Hood. Look, we've gotten to this point for a few reasons. The main reason is that over the past 40 years or so, the elites in this country, in the government, in the media, especially in the educational system, the left-wing elites, have laid down this gauntlet of political correctness. They are setting the tone. Every time you criticize Islamic terrorism, you are an Islamophobe. You are a racist. This is the tone they have set. It's political correctness run amok. It's multiculturalism madness, I guess you would call it. And at the root of this, Mark, is a dislike among our elites, a visceral dislike for Judeo-Christian Western civilization, the tenets that founded our country. They don't like them. They'd like to turn them on their heads. They see the Muslim world, and they see oppressed victims. They're not Western. They're not Judeo-Christian, so they must be good, and they must be defended at all costs. This is the backwards, insane philosophy of our elites in this country, and it's this kind of philosophy that enabled Fort Hood to happen, and it's going to enable many more Fort Hoods to happen if we don't check it.
You mentioned that no one is using the word, you know, Islamist when referring to the Fort Hood shooting. We see that with the underwear bomber, with the Times Square bomber, and the Fort Hood shooter, Major Hassan. There's this tendency to try to write all of these off as isolated incidents where these people were working 100% by themselves. True or false?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's a false narrative. Absolutely, Mark. But to the Obama administration, absolutely, this is true. This is what they're pushing us. And look, there's a reason the subtitle of my book is called How the Government is Deceiving You, the American People, about the Islamist Threat. This is Exhibit A. As you mentioned, every time we see an attempt or a successful Islamic terror attack on American soil, we're told this is just the work of an isolated extremist, a one-off, with no broader links to any global movement. That's just a lie. In every case, Hassan, Times Square, underwear bomber, they had links to Al-Qaeda overseas, and the Times Square bomber had trained in Pakistan. There is a broader link. There is a broader movement, and they're lying to the American people to tell them otherwise. Here's another thing, Mark. We're not up against violent extremism or man-made disasters, as the Obama administration tells us. We are fighting Islamic terrorism. Terrorism is only a tactic. Terrorism is only a tactic. There is a well-defined, well-established ideology that motivates the terrorism. You know, Mark, I describe in the book, I've sat down face-to-face with Al-Qaeda-linked terrorists, associates of Osama bin Laden, and they've told me to my face, we're not doing this because of poverty, because of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. We are doing this because of Islamic ideology. Islam's core texts command us to do this. This is what they're saying. Now, that's the height of political incorrectness, but this is no time to mince words. And if they're telling us, or the bad guys, that Islam's core text, Islam's history, its teachings are motivating them, we need to listen to that. That's one example where we actually do need to listen to the bad guys, because they're laying it out for us. They're telling us why they're doing what they're doing, but this administration will not wrap its head around that.
One of the things we know from looking at the 9/11 hijackers playbook is that their goal before the event was to blend in to American society, to become one of us, shave your beards, join a gym. When you see people on the street, smile, wave, be friendly. And you mentioned in the book that know your enemy is certainly one of the beliefs of these terrorists. Talk to us about that a little bit. How hard are they trying to blend into American society, to gain that trust?
Well, trying very hard. There's a crucial, crucial component of this that every listener should know, Mark. Taqiyya. That is an Arabic word, taqiyya. It means deception. And these guys are taqiyya masters. You are permitted in the world of jihad to lie to your enemy. You are permitted to lie to the infidel, and they're trying very hard to blend in. I think one of the best examples I show in the book, Mark, is in the South, in rural North Carolina, of all places. I describe how a 9-man Islamic terrorist cell set up shop in the countryside, the rolling hills outside of Raleigh, North Carolina, the last place you would expect. But this 9-man terrorist cell, led by a white convert to Islam, they were plotting to blow up U.S. military installations, training in the North Carolina countryside in bombs and shooting automatic weapons. Now, I went down there. I spent time on the ground. Went to the cell leader's home. I describe all of this in the book. I went to every neighbor's house, Mark, knocked on every door, and said, "What did you think of Daniel Boyd?" That was the cell leader's name. "What was he like?" Every single person in that beautiful, well-manicured cul-de-sac where he lived said that he was a great guy, that we never saw this coming. There's no way he could be guilty of this. He was a part of the fabric of the community. He helped us mow our lawns. His wife babysat our kids. This is the blueprint for these guys. Talk about Takiya. This is what they do.
And they obviously do it very well. Right now, with everything that's going on in Tunisia, Algeria, Egypt, Libya, a lot of people are embracing this as a democracy movement. What's your take?
Mark, it's anything but. This so-called Arab Spring is going to end up being a disaster for America and also for Israel. Number one, Egypt. Now, Hosni Mubarak, the deposed Egyptian president, he was not a good guy, but in Egypt, he's about as good as you're going to get. He kept that peace treaty with Israel for 31 years. He opposed Hamas. He opposed Al-Qaeda. He was friendly to the U.S., yet the Obama administration threw him under the bus when they knew that the biggest beneficiary of a post-Mubarak Egypt would be the Muslim Brotherhood. The Muslim Brotherhood is the most organized, most powerful, strongest opposition force in that country. Why is that problematic? Because the Muslim Brotherhood is the granddaddy of them all when it comes to Islamic terror groups. Yet it looks like, now that Mubarak's gone, that the Brotherhood, if not right away, eventually is going to take over Egypt. We will have a radical Islamic state in Egypt. The Obama administration helped this happen. And they've reached out to the Muslim Brotherhood time and time again. But not only Egypt. In Libya, what's the end game? Al-Qaeda and the Muslim Brotherhood have strong presences in Libya. In a place like Yemen, where we're seeing this so-called Arab Spring, and the Obama administration is also pushing the leader out, Al-Qaeda just conquered two towns in southern Yemen. In a place like Bahrain, where we've seen protest, Iran will move right in, right across the Gulf into Bahrain. So across the board, with the possible exception of Syria, look, it doesn't get much worse than the Assad regime in Syria. With the possible exception of Syria, the alternative to all of these regimes that are falling, and Tunisia, which is a pretty moderate place by Islamic standards, with the possible exceptions of Tunisia, Syria, all of these countries that are struggling and that are having regimes teetering on the brink, the alternative is radical Islamists. Literally, Mark, in every single country. Yet the Obama administration thinks this is a great thing, and they're going to give billions and billions in aid to assist this so-called Arab Spring, this so-called democracy movement. It's madness. It's not realistic.
You know, one of the things that Glenn Beck has pointed out is that we even have 60s radicals like Bill Ayers running around over there. We have Code Pink running around over there. What is the connection between the American left and the Islamic terrorists?
Well, this is a long-standing connection, Mark, that goes back really to the late 60s, even the 70s, even to the Iranian Revolution. At the end of the day, and speaking of Code Pink and these far-left groups, we're about to see one of these new flotillas filled with so-called activists, pro-Palestinian activists, assault Israel's shores once again later this month. We remember what happened last year when Israel had to defend itself, when ships full of these communist and left-wing and Muslim radicals tried to break the Gaza blockade. That's coming in late June.
What was the name of the last flotilla, Eric?
The Mavi Marmara, I think it was pronounced, launched out of Turkey. This one, a funny point here, Mark, this flotilla that's coming in late June, and the Israelis are gearing up for it, this flotilla, one of the ships, is called The Audacity of Hope, which was the name of one of Barack Obama's books. Very telling.
Right.
But look, the ties here, Mark, between the left and Islam, at the end of the day, it all boils down to this. When you see the left and you see Muslim radicals marching side by side at anti-war rallies, anti-capitalism rallies, you scratch your head and say, wow, they have nothing in common. But at the end of the day, they have one very important thing in common, a hatred of America, of the U.S. Constitution, of the Ten Commandments, of Judeo-Christian Western civilization. They hate everything this country and this civilization stands for. They want to turn it on its head. So they'll put aside their differences to work together to fulfill that goal. But a word of caution for our friends on the left. If you look back to 1979 and the Iranian Revolution, when the Ayatollah came to power, communists, Marxists, liberals, socialists, they were all behind the Ayatollah. He's a man of democracy. Well, when the Ayatollah Khomeini came to power, the first thing he did, Mark, was lock up all the liberals and either have them executed or thrown in prison for life. So a word of caution to our short-sighted buddies on the left, they have no idea who they're getting in bed with here when they get in bed with radical Islamists. And I talk about this relationship in the book.
One of the old sayings is those who do not pay attention to history are destined to repeat it. Apparently, that message has fallen on deaf ears as far as the left is concerned. I want to talk to you not only about the Ground Zero Mosque, but mosques in general. A lot of people say if you oppose a large multi-million dollar mosque being built in your neighborhood, you're a racist, you're an Islamophobe. Are there legitimate reasons for opposing these structures in your neighborhood?
Mark, there are so many reasons. I count them down in a chapter in the book called Mega Mosque Nation, because that's what we're seeing. Real quick, a number for you. In the year 2001, there were 1,200 mosques in America. Now, 10 years later, in 2011, that number has nearly doubled. There are now over 2,000 mosques in America. That's astounding. In only 10 years, the number of mosques in this country, since 9/11, mind you, has nearly doubled. That is simply astounding, and here's why it's a problem. I've been in the mosques, Mark, from coast to coast in America, in Europe. I've interviewed the imams. I've been in the mosques. I've been in the Islamic enclaves. I recount all of this in the book. This is my on-the-ground experiences, and I can tell you that in these mosques, the literature comes straight from Saudi Arabia. In a majority of these mosques, the literature is provided by Muslim Brotherhood-connected groups. The imams can't tell you that they recognize Israel's right to exist, can't tell you that Hamas and Hezbollah are terror groups, can't tell you that Sharia law, Islamic law, is a bad thing for America. This is the issue. 80% of all American mosques have Saudi funding behind them. And when it comes to these mega mosques, Ground Zero is just the tip of the iceberg. There are mega mosques, Mark, multi-million dollar massive structures going up from coast to coast in places you would never expect. In the Bible Belt outside of Nashville, Tennessee, in rural Wisconsin, northern Kentucky, Alaska just broke ground on its first mosque. This is not a coincidence. This is the blueprint. Set up mosques as beachheads. And in the book, I recount, not every mosque, but in many mosques, terrorism financing, terrorism plotting has gone on in a good enough number of mosques that we should be concerned about their rapid construction in this country.
I had Laurie Cardoza Moore on a few weeks ago, and her group, Proclaiming Justice to the Nations, was fighting a mosque in her hometown. And of course, when you go online, she is being attacked with every single name in the book. She's, like we discussed already, an Islamophobe. She's a racist. She spews hatred, religious intolerance. I mean, you name it. But one of the things you point out in the book is that these mosques are, in fact, I mean, even when you take away the funding and the literature, they are safe havens for Islamic terrorists.
You know, first of all, Laurie Cardoza Moore is a brave woman, and she's doing important work down there, Mark. In Murfreesboro, Tennessee, yes, of all places, there's only some 250 Muslim families in the whole town, yet they're getting a multi-million dollar massive complex spread out over 15 acres of land. Why so big? About six buildings on this structure, and built right next to a Baptist church, by the way, which is not a coincidence. It's a show of dominance. So when we talk about some of the activities that you mentioned that go on inside these structures, in the book I interviewed a former member of Iran's Revolutionary Guards Corps. Now this is the strongest element of the Iranian regime. And he was a guy who worked for the Iranians in their operations inside the mosques in Europe and, yes, America. And he told me, look, Iran is working in mosques in the West to plot, to train, to finance, to find safe haven. Now, Iran is doing that. Our greatest enemy, Iran. We know the Saudis are behind 80% of the funding in American mosques. We know in Europe that a country like Turkey, which is quickly turning to the radical Islamic side, is also building mosques. This is a problem. Yet in a place like Saudi Arabia, a place like Iran, you cannot build a church. You cannot build a synagogue. You cannot even bring a Bible into these countries. Yet because of our tolerance run amok, we're letting them establish beachheads in this country.
Eric, is there any doubt in your mind that the Ground Zero Mosque was meant to be a trophy of sorts, their history is to build mosques on the site of important victories. Is that how you viewed the Ground Zero Mosque?
Mark, absolutely. Anyone who has a passing knowledge of Islamic history, Islamic theology, Islamic ideology knows that the Ground Zero Mosque is an Islamic victory arch. It's the Islamic equivalent of a Roman victory arch. That's what I call it in the book. Look, it's two blocks from where Ground Zero occurred, the greatest Islamic terrorist attack in U.S. history. Some of the landing gear from one of the planes actually hit the building where the mosque is going to be housed. So yes, it was directly affected by the attacks. Landing gear, for God's sake. They know exactly what they're doing. This is very well thought out. This is very well planned. Imam Rauf is a guy who was the face of this project, who the mainstream media calls a moderate. And President Obama, remember, endorsed the Ground Zero Mosque. Rauf is a guy who's been linked to the Muslim Brotherhood. So another important thing to remember here, defenders of this project, Mark, they say it's not a mosque, it's an Islamic center. Well, I can tell you, I've been in Islamic centers throughout the U.S., throughout Europe, and I can tell you, when Muslims go there every Friday, they don't say, hey, let's go down to the Islamic center. They say, let's go to the mosque. They consider it a mosque, and really, at the end of the day, that's all that matters, what they look at it as. They consider it a mosque, and the centerpiece of any Islamic center is a huge, elaborate mosque. We call a Protestant megachurch a church, don't we? Then we should call these so-called Islamic centers mosques, because that's exactly what they are, and that's exactly how Muslims view them.
One of the things I've seen are just some scary signs coming in from around the world where other countries have been tolerant of this. I've seen pictures coming in from Scandinavia, videos coming in from Scandinavia, where peaceful Jews who were demonstrating, not causing any problems, being very well behaved, were being spat upon and had rocks thrown at them while police stood by and did nothing. How is it that around the world it seems like they've somehow even convinced the police to fall into a sense of complacency and also to be concerned about political correctness?
Well, that same political correctness has taken root here, Mark, has taken root a million times worse in Europe. And at the root of it is a lack of confidence, a lack of cultural confidence in Europe. They've been stripped of any vestiges of their Judeo-Christian Western heritage, Western civilization, any pride in their culture, in their history, in Christianity, in Judaism. They've been stripped of that in Europe. What you have left is an ultra-secular, hedonistic place that's hostile to Judeo-Christianity to the West, especially among Europe's elites. Then you have Islam coming in massive numbers, massive immigration into Europe, replacing the dwindling birth rates of native Europeans. And when these Muslims come into Europe, they're coming filled with religious zeal. They know what their goals are. They know what they're fighting for. They know exactly what they want. The native Europeans, hedonistic, ungrounded, rootless, are sitting there. They're throwing their hands up. They don't know what to do. And Islam is taking root, and they're coming to Europe not to assimilate, but to dominate. And I've been to Europe, Mark, in neighborhoods, and I talk about it in the book, like you describe in Scandinavia, which are no-go zones for police, where Muslims self-segregate themselves. In Great Britain, for example, Great Britain, there are over 80 fully functioning Islamic Sharia courts in Britain, where Islamic law is deciding marital disputes and what have you. And if they have their way, it eventually will decide everything, and Sharia judges will serve as judge, jury, and executioner. And I can tell you, Winston Churchill is turning in his grave.
Eric, one of the things we both know is that under Sharia law, women are nothing more than second-class citizens. Where are the female rights groups, the women's rights groups, if you will, on the left in opposing this? Why aren't we seeing America's largest women's groups come out and protest against this idea of bringing Sharia law to America?
Yeah, it's a question I've asked many times since 9/11, Mark, and at the end of the day, it all boils down to this, and I mentioned it earlier. For the left, and all these women's groups are run and dominated, bought and paid for by the left. They're creatures of the left, all these major women's groups. They simply cannot bring themselves to criticize what they view as another oppressed minority group, Muslims. That gets to the root of it. That goes against leftist dogma. Thou shalt not criticize brown people and non-Christian third worlders. I guess that's the unwritten law of the left. And women's, these leading women's groups are part of the left. They can't do that. They simply can't. They can't criticize another fellow oppressed minority group who, like them, does not like Judeo-Christian Western civilization. I think that's what it boils down to.
Well, one of the things we've seen is that they not only didn't go after Bill Clinton during the Monica Lewinsky affair, they also stayed quiet on the O.J. Simpson case. Right. There's a real tendency on the part of these leftist women's groups to not want to go after anyone else on the left. And as we've already pointed out, that there is that close tie between the Islamic extremist and the American leftist. Now, I want to stay on women's rights for just a second, because I got to tell you, Eric, one of the most disturbing things in the book to me, I mean, something that really put knots in my stomach, was whenever you described the situation in England where young English girls, as young as age 13, are being recruited by these slick-talking Muslims with nice clothes and nice cars, and they're essentially being recruited into a life of sexual slavery.
Yeah. You know, Mark, this is one of the most disturbing revelations in the book, I think, and it's something that no one knows anything about, and it's something the British elites, our lefty friends, once again, don't dare speak about. As you said, young English girls, white English girls, native girls, and they're purposely targeted because they're white and because they're Christian by these smooth-talking Pakistani Muslim gangs in Great Britain and some of the working-class areas of Britain, where Pakistani Muslims have set up shop in a powerful way. They control the drug trade. They're building mosques. They control these neighborhoods. These young, naive, white English girls, Christian girls, are recruited by these guys, sweet-talked, and literally become sex slaves. It's a growing epidemic in Great Britain, and I can tell you, I talked to some guys in Great Britain who live in these towns, and it was amazing, Mark, to talk to them. They would talk about girls they grew up with, and they'd say, oh yeah, she's a Muslim now, she's wearing a burqa. I mean, unbelievable. British girls just leaving behind everything, their families, their friends, converting to Islam, marrying Pakistani Muslims, and leaving behind everything, wearing the burqa, and they're just one of many wives. From what these Brits tell me, the Pakistanis have, the white English girls are for child rearing, and then they have their Pakistani wives. And this isn't just me just spouting off alarmism, trying to scare people. This is really happening in Great Britain. And even some British publications have been brave enough to write about it. The Daily Mail, for one, which is a leading newspaper in Great Britain, has actually written about this. And like I said, I've heard it from the Brits' own mouths. And when I was in Great Britain, Mark, to give you an example how bad it is, I interviewed Al-Qaeda-linked terrorists who are living freely in Great Britain, freely, in nice homes, and collecting welfare benefits from the state. This is a true story. This is happening in Great Britain right now. Sayonara. They're done. Stick a fork in them. Great Britain is done.
I want to be clear on this. You said that they're being recruited into sexual slavery. Does that also include prostitution?
Oh, yes. In some cases, absolutely it does. And they're being targeted specifically because they're white and because they're not Muslims. For the Pakistani Muslims, oftentimes it's just a way to rub salt in the wounds of the infidel and corrupt them in their view. They're looked at as less than human because they're not Muslim. in a lot of cases by these Pakistani Muslims. They look at these girls as infidels who can be used and discarded, and women in general in Islam are regarded as complete inferiors and abused. But the fact that they are a Christian and the fact that they are white gives a little extra added pleasure for these Pakistani Muslim gangs who take advantage of them in a horrible way.
You made a reference earlier in the interview to the birth rate of these Muslim families. One of the things that Muammar Gaddafi is famous for saying is that Muslims will eventually take over America without firing a shot. I don't know if this number is accurate, but some of the things I've read suggest that the average number of children per Muslim household in the United States is 8. And that eventually they'll have the population to control the votes, and that they might very well be able to take over America without firing a shot. What are your thoughts on this, Eric?
Well, that's the blueprint. I mean, that's definitely the blueprint, Mark. And a group like, I think of a group like the Muslim Brotherhood, which is the most powerful Islamic group in the world, really. The most influential, the largest. And they're radical Islamists. They're jihadists. But once again, taqiyya, which we talked about, these are guys who wear suits. They're well-spoken. They're eloquent. They have so much influence. At the end of the day, their strategy is different than Al-Qaeda's. Al-Qaeda wants to blow you up now, kill you now. The Brotherhood's patient. The Brotherhood will gain power legally through elections, the media, the educational institutions. But at the end of the day, the end game is the same. Islamic Sharia law and a worldwide caliphate and destruction of the infidels. The end game is the same. So in the U.S., their strategy is to do it through legal means, through demographics, like you mentioned, through massive Muslim immigration, which we're seeing more and more of, through legal means, through legal channels. We'll win through elections. We'll influence the American people, the American view of Islam, through the media, through the educational institutions. This is their strategy for America. We'll build mosques. We'll build thousands and thousands of mosques and Islamic schools, which is happening right now. This isn't alarmism. Again, these are facts that are well documented and that I've seen with my own two eyes. It's working to perfection in Europe, to perfection. They're losing their society to Islam. And in the U.S., the blueprint is the same. Demographics, and you can do it nonviolently. A leading Muslim Brotherhood scholar, spiritual leader of the Brotherhood in Egypt, said a few years ago, we will conquer Europe, this time not through violent jihad, but through what they call dawah, which means proselytizing, and through immigration, demographic jihad. And it's happening under our noses, and we're so ignorant about the enemy, their goals, their motivations, that we're letting it happen.
You've given us a couple of sneak peeks into their blueprint. What should the Judeo-Christian blueprint be for stopping this?
Well, Mark, number one, get informed. Please, I implore people, put down your iPod, turn off the game, turn off American Idol for just 15 minutes a day. That's all it takes. And get informed as to what is going on in the world. You owe it to yourself, your kids, your grandkids. There are events happening in the Muslim world right now, and in our backyard, as I describe in the book, that are going to fundamentally alter our lives. These are tumultuous times, earth-shattering events. You need to know what's coming, what's going on. So get informed. You don't have to be an Islamic expert or a political junkie. 15, 20 minutes a day, that's all it takes. Number two, get with like-minded people. You can do it now through social networking. Look at the Tea Party. Look at the power, the influence of the Tea Party, all they've accomplished. You can do that. There are groups also devoted to radical Islam in this threat. Get with like-minded people, make your voice heard. And third, get in your congressman, your local, federal, state officials, get in their ears. If you have a mosque being built down the block, then you go into that mosque and you see there's anti-Semitic literature, anti-American literature, you let them know. Let your elected officials know. Because I can tell you, I work in Washington, Mark, and I can tell you that when a congressman's office gets flooded with calls, it works, it's effective, and they respond.
One of the ways that our listeners can begin educating themselves is to read your book. With the time we have left, tell our listeners how they can get a hold of a copy.
Well, Mark, you can buy it at Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble, Borders, wherever books are sold. You can also get a free chapter at www.terroristnextdoorbook.com.
Excellent. Well, we're going to throw up a few links on our website, and you're going to be featured in this week's newsletter, which is called the Tea Party Telegram, and we'll have some links in the newsletter as well. Speaking of the newsletter, anyone who would like to subscribe to it, just send me an email, mark@teapartypowerhour.com, and we'll get you on that mailing list. Eric, that's all the time we have today. I want to thank you for being here. Very, very informative. I'm not finished with the book, but it's an excellent read, and I can tell you that it is a real eye-opener, and you will never look at things the same way again. Once again, Eric, thanks for being here. We'd love to have you back sometime.
Mark, I'd love to. Thanks so much. It was a real pleasure, and God bless. Take care.
You've been listening to the Tea Party Power Hour with Mark Gillar, a production of the Conservative Broadcasting Network.